This is Focus 580, our morning talk program, the second hour of the show. Glad to have you with us. My name is David Inge. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne is at the controls. In this hour of the program, we'll spend some time talking about the idea of the practice of nonviolence. And our guest for the show is Mark Kurlansky. He's authored a new book that's just out that explores it. And in the book, he talks about, first of all, talks about the fact that throughout history, there have been many practitioners of nonviolence. It is a concept, he writes, that has been praised by every major religion. At the same time, he argues that consistently over history, the political and the cultural establishment has tried to marginalize nonviolence. The reason, he says, it's because nonviolence is one of the truly rare revolutionary ideas, an idea that seeks to completely change the nature of society. And for that reason, he argues, the concept and the people who have practiced it have been considered profoundly dangerous. The book that we're talking about is titled Nonviolence, 25 Lessons from the History of a Dangerous Idea. It is recently published by Modern Library, and I'm sure it's a book that you could find in the bookstore if you'd like to seek it out. Questions, comments, of course, are always welcome as we move through the hour. If you'd like to join us and share your thoughts, you can certainly do that by calling 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. Let me tell you a little bit more about Mark Kurlansky. He's the author of a number of books, and he's written on a number of different subjects, on politics. He's written a number of books about food, including the bestseller Cod, A Biography of the Fish That Changed the World, Salt, A World History, and most recently, The Big Oyster, History on the Half Shell. He's also written about American history and politics in the bestseller 1968, The Year That Changed That Rocked the World, pardon me. He's written fiction. He's also written some children's books. He began his career as a foreign correspondent, writing about the last years of Francoism in Spain, especially in the Basque provinces. For 25 years, he's reported on international affairs from the Caribbean, Paris, Mexico. He's also written extensively about Europe and Latin America. He's been a regular contributor to the Partisan Review and has also written for the International Herald Tribune, the Chicago Tribune, Harper's, the New York Times Magazine, among other publications. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to join us, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Mr. Kurlansky, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I appreciate it. What is, obviously, this is something that you have been thinking about for some time. What moved you to want to write this book?
Well, as you say correctly, it's something I've been thinking about all of my life, really, and I refused the draft during the Vietnam War and obviously thought a lot about it then. And I think that the Iraq and Afghanistan wars brought it once again to the forefront of my thoughts. I'm very disturbed, you know, that in this day and age, these old mistakes are still being made. You know, I constantly ask myself, what can we do about all this? Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, we have to try to incrementally change the world. One of the ways in which you can do that is to get people to question some of the entrenched ideas that are part of our culture. I find that there are a great many entrenched things in our culture that promote violence and promote warfare, that the way history is taught greatly glorifies warfare and really represses the history of nonviolence, the idea that there are alternative ways to act. And I think we have to start questioning these things. I think we have to start questioning the American Revolution and the Civil War and World War II and all of it. A great many veterans come home with the conclusion that there has to be a better way to solve problems, and there are better ways, and they have been done, and they have been successful, and we need to talk more about this.
Well, let me, I'm sure that the main sort of argument you get from people is that there are times when, in order to deal with, there'll be governments and there'll be individuals who are more than willing to use violence to get what they want, and that there are times that the only response, the only thing that can stop those people is, in fact, application of force. It's the use of violence. And I'm sure that people, they'll pick whatever their favorite example is. And they will say that nonviolence is all well and good, and that it can and has achieved a lot, but there are certain points where it simply fails, that it can't. It's not big enough. When we're confronted with massive evil employing violence, there's nothing what we can do but respond in kind.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually one of the better arguments. Some people argue that nonviolence can't work at all, which is which shows how negligent we've been in teaching history, because, in fact, it has worked quite frequently, but you're right. This is an argument that has some validity. But if you look at history, violence always comes with consequences that don't satisfactorily resolve the things that they were trying to resolve. And governments that pursue violence are often not honest about the agenda that they have, and so people end up fighting for something quite different than what they think they're fighting for.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose that it is the case that there have always been arguments that whatever war we were in was the war to end all war, and somehow that never quite achieves that.
Well, of course, that's a fundamental absurdity that you could have a war to end war. That's what the problem is with the war on terrorism. Is that, war is terrorism. So it's terrorism to end terrorism. If you engage in terror, you're promoting a world of terror, so that's not going to end it.
I think you begin by making what is an interesting observation about how it is that we talk about nonviolence, and the fact that as we look for words to describe it, talk about what it is we're doing, we seem to fall back on saying what, not so much saying what it is, but saying what it's not. We have this word nonviolence, but that we don't really have a good word for what it is we're talking about. And I think that you also make the argument for those people who would say, well, what we're talking about is pacifism. You'd say, no, that's something else.
Right, David. I mean, nonviolence is a program of political activism. It's a way to pursue a program that does not involve doing harm to the adversaries, and it's a fantastically interesting linguistic issue that in no language does there exist a proactive word for nonviolence. In all languages, including the Indian word ahimsa, it's the negation of violence, nonviolence. Suppose we lived in a world in which there was a word for nonviolence, but there was no word for violence except non, whatever this other word was. What kind of a world would that be? That would be a world in which nonviolence was considered the normal way to act and violence was considered an aberration. That's the kind of world I would like to live in. Language is a tremendous, clue to things that the fact that no language has this word. In fact, Gandhi invented a word which, interestingly, never caught on, perhaps because it was too rooted to Eastern language or too hard to remember, satyagraha. But it indicates a way of thinking and a way of the agenda that is promoted by our culture. Just think of movies, think of monuments and parks, everything in our culture, the toys that children play. I was just watching the Cartoon Network with my young daughter yesterday morning, and the commercials for toys were absolutely astounding. I mean, they had this thing called a battleship in which they advertised that they had actually recorded battleships in battle so the children could play with this toy and hear real battle sounds. Something wrong with our society there.
Let me introduce again very quickly our guest, Mark Kurlansky. He has written on a wide range of subjects. He's written about politics. He's written about history. He's written about food. He has written fiction, nonfiction. He's written for children. His newest book, the one here we're talking about this morning, it's just out. The title is Nonviolence, 25 Lessons from the History of a Dangerous Idea. It's published by Modern Library. And questions are certainly welcome. If you want to be involved in the conversation, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think another point that you make, it's something I'd like to have you talk about, just because we seem to be at a moment where there's some acceleration of attack on organized religion, because people say, well, there has been a lot of evil done in the name of God by various people, and I guess you can't really deny that. At the same time, I think it is important to make the point, as you do in the book, that really all religions have this is an idea that really all religions have endorsed.
Yeah, of course, religions also have endorsed violence. But if you look at history, you will see that a profound change takes place in religions when the state becomes involved. The classic example of that is Christianity, which for something like 285 years was a very marginalized peace cult that refused to take part in any kind of violence, to the extent that they would not participate in any government because governments were intrinsically violent. And then the Emperor Constantine has a dream and announces that Christianity is now acceptable in the Roman Empire, and he sees crosses to go into battle, and he fights battles and kills people in the name of Jesus Christ, and does untold damage to the religion and the essential beliefs of the religion. And all religions have these moments where states do these things to them.
And so I would assume that you would reject the notion that somehow humans are by their nature violent.
I reject the notion that warfare is a natural act. I think that people do have in their nature. I mean, you see in children that they argue and they get angry and they get frustrated and they hit each other, and you have to teach them not to hit, and all of these things are true, but that is a long way from organized warfare. And if you talk to anybody who is involved or has ever been involved in the military in the training of recruits, they will tell you that what they ask of recruits is something very unnatural, and the whole purpose of boot camp is to try to reconstruct their morality and their mentality to get them to do things that are against their nature.
So this is your argument. It's not so much that it's unnatural for somebody to get frustrated with another and just want to reach out and smack them. It's the idea of somebody saying, well, let's all of us get together in this organized way and go over the hill and go and beat on those people over there.
Exactly. And that, you know, one state can resolve its issues with another state by getting, you know, the young people of their society together and organize them as this vast killing machine.
Let's get at the subtitle a little bit, because I think that is an interesting idea. True, I think, and one of the things that you acknowledge in your text as you discuss it, and then in the 25 lessons briefly stated at the back, the idea that the practice of nonviolence and the people who advocate practicing nonviolence are considered to be dangerous, and particularly by the establishment, by government, in fact, maybe even by established religion, that these people tend to be viewed as troublemakers. They're a problem because they're bucking the system, I suppose.
Yeah, and they often end up getting killed. And then after they're killed, they're turned into saints. And the canonization, the process of making them saints, somehow defangs them. If you look at Martin Luther King, Martin Luther King was a rebel. He was a political activist who ardently wanted to change a great many things about our society. And now on Martin Luther King Day, a lot of politicians who Martin Luther King would have vehemently opposed get up and they say all these laudatory things about Martin Luther King, presenting him, you know, almost as this kind of saintly holy man. But in his lifetime, the fact is that the United States government saw him as a very dangerous man. He spent his whole political life being persecuted by the FBI.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? Someone who is here in Urbana, where we are. Line number one.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to say thank you to WILL for having this guest. I think it's an underreported topic, and I'm really glad to hear it on the air. The other thing is, I think when you say why are peacemakers considered and nonviolent peacemakers considered, a threat, it's because there are an awful lot of people on both sides of the war who are benefiting from it financially and through gaining power. And so I think it's no wonder that we're considered subversive, because were there not all these wars, there would not be all this war machinery that gets a lot of people a lot of money. And I'm going to hang up and listen to the guest.
All right. Well,
yeah, I mean, I think that's quite true. I think that those of us who, you know, oppose the Iraq War are considered a menace by the Halliburton Corporation, for example. But I think beyond that, the state considers killing human beings to be their exclusive privilege. I mean, if you think of capital punishment, which most civilized countries don't practice anymore, the whole idea of capital punishment is that it's wrong to kill other human beings, and therefore, if you do kill another human being, the state, the only person who has the right to kill, the only entity that has the right to kill, will kill you. Governments see the ability and the right, the privilege of killing other people as one of their important tools. People who advocate nonviolence are suggesting that that tool be removed. And then it becomes much more profound than that, because the whole notion of the state and the notion of power has to change. The idea that a government should be seeking advantage for its country at the expense of other countries has to be changed. You know, that was an interesting thing about the very long process of building a united Europe, which dates back to the mid-19th century. And, you know, the original idea, the original purpose was to end war in Europe. And the reason that it would end war in Europe is it would create a system of cooperating states rather than adversary states. Well, you know, we all should be cooperating states.
You talked earlier about the fact that there are people who would, in arguing against the idea, who would say, well, nonviolence really hasn't ever accomplished anything. And you would say that you would make the counterargument, you'd say, well, that's not the case. And if you think that, it's because you haven't been properly educated about the history of nonviolence or maybe the history of the world. Give me an example. What you would think, perhaps your best example, or more than one, if you want, of what nonviolence actually has achieved.
Yeah, well, I'll give you a couple of interesting examples aside from, you know, the well known ones like Indian independence and the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. The fall of the Soviet Union. If you think back to when the Soviet Union fell, and everybody talked about what an amazing surprise this was and how the Soviet Union just seemed to collapse overnight. And, you know, later on reflection, some people decided that, you know, it was the Cold War and we had won the Cold War. And you know, Ronald Reagan decided that somehow he must have done it after he learned that it happened. But the fact is, that a great number of people, such as Václav Havel and in Czechoslovakia and Adam Michnik in Poland, set about, after the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968, to overthrow the Soviet Union nonviolently. And they studied Gandhi, and they studied the concept of non-cooperation. And it was that non-cooperation that disintegrated the Soviet Union, which Gorbachev has written about in his memoirs. He doesn't say, you know, we lost the Cold War. He talks about going to Czechoslovakia in you know, 1970 and discovering that, you know, in the country where Russians were most loved, there suddenly nobody would talk to them, and how this is the roots of something that was going to lead to deep trouble. And, you know, and it's interesting how much the world ignores the accomplishments of these nonviolent groups that brought down the Soviet Union. Another interesting example is South Africa, which was a violent movement. Nelson Mandela turned the ANC into a violent armed guerrilla group, and pretty much everything they did was disastrous. You know, something that people often say to me is, you know, suppose you have a group that's really, you know, really violent and well-armed, you know, how can nonviolence work against them? Well, the truth is nonviolence is the only thing that can work against them, because when you try to use violence against them, you're just hopelessly slaughtered, which is what happened to the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. Finally, after a very long time of enduring these kinds of slaughters, they started realizing that there were all sorts of nonviolent things they could do, that the white minority economically lived off of doing business with the black community, and that they had a lot of power in their hands in that way and in other ways that were nonviolent. And apartheid crumbled very quickly. Once they started using these techniques. Mm-hmm. The problem with nonviolence is that it takes a great deal of courage, a great deal of discipline, and a great deal of imagination. I mean, if you think about it, in invading, the military invasion of another country, such as we did in Afghanistan and in Iraq, is the most unimaginative thing you could possibly do. To be successful with nonviolence, you have to think creatively. You also have to understand in a profound way the culture, both your own culture and the culture of your adversary.
Mm-hmm. I guess I would expect, though, that there would be some people who would point to the examples that you had given, South Africa or even the Soviet Union, as being cases where a social system is eventually brought down by its own internal contradictions, and that's something that has a certain inevitability about it, and that perhaps people can nudge that process along by, in whatever way they can, saying, well, I'm not going to contribute to the maintenance of this system anymore. But it seems that there's a difference between that and applying nonviolence to militarist dictatorship intent on dominating its own country or dominating its neighbors using force. That seems that again, that's the example that people are going to come back to again and again and say, well, yes, in fact, I can see there are some places where nonviolence can be a very powerful tool, and yet others where it's simply that's not going to work because the power that we're fighting against is simply just, it's just going to mow us down, and so turning the other cheek is not going to work.
Well, David, I would agree with your characterization of South Africa and the Soviet Union. And I mean, it is fundamentally the idea of how nonviolence works, that you just contribute to that, you know, falling apart of an untenable situation. But it would be very strange for somebody before the 1990s to hear you talk like this about the Soviet Union, because, you know, it was always said that the Soviet Union was this ruthless military dictatorship, and the success of Gandhi was always said, especially by the British. You know, it was always said that Gandhi was able to succeed because the British were really not that bad, despite the fact they did mow people down with machine guns.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, George Orwell, in an essay, said saying how, you know, this was so, and that Gandhi could not work in other kinds of, you know, what you're talking about in brutal military societies, used as an example the Soviet Union. There's a lot of different situations that you have to adapt this this approach to, and as I say, you have to think creatively. And I would accept the idea, you know, that theoretically there might be a situation where it wouldn't work. I suppose nothing always works. But it works most of the time if you're able to figure out a way to do it. Gandhi said that if you were not able to resist nonviolently, you had a moral obligation to resist violently. That the essential obligation was to resist, and I believe that the underpinning of this idea was that there is a nonviolent way to resist, but if you can't find it, then you have to do something else.
We are a bit past the midpoint. I have a couple of callers here we'll get right to. I do again want to introduce our guest, Mark Kurlansky. He's authored a number of books. He's written fiction, nonfiction, and also children's books. He's written about European history. He's written about America. He was the author of the bestseller 1968, The Year That Rocked the World. He's also written a number of books about food, including the bestseller Cod, A Biography of the Fish That Changed the World, the book Salt, A World History, and most recently, The Big Oyster, History on the Half Shell. He began his career as a foreign correspondent, writing about the last years of Francoism in Spain. He's also reported on international affairs from the Caribbean, from Paris and Mexico, and has written quite a lot about Europe and Latin America. His new book on the subject here we're discussing this morning is Nonviolence, subtitled 25 Lessons from the History of a Dangerous Idea. It's published by the Modern Library, and you should be able to find it in the bookstore now. Questions, comments are welcome. If you want to be involved in the conversation, that's certainly great. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here, both in Champaign. First, line one. Hello.
Hi. I think that at least to be accurate and honest, some of your argument is just off, even though I agree with you about the importance of nonviolence. So let me start with Gandhi. Though you praise him as the, let's say, archetype of a nonviolent political action, I would say to a great extent Gandhi is also archetype of political action failure. And by this I mean the partition of India and Pakistan between Muslims and Hindu, the enormous amount of violence that resulted from the failure to handle that, and Gandhi's failure to handle that in terms of any nonviolent way. I mean, the amount of people killed in that is atrocious. The fact that Gandhi himself was killed as in part because of his inability to handle the underlying conflict between Hindus and Muslims. That's one point in terms of Gandhi, and I'll take it a step further. I mean, when Gandhi was asked about Hitler and the Holocaust, I mean, he made a statement like, well, the Jews should have thrown themselves on the spears, so to speak. In other words, let themselves be killed and shame Hitler into stopping it, which just shows a complete inadequacy of that idea in the face of certain other kinds of intolerance, hatred, and violence, i.e., one, Hitler's, two, the animosity between Muslims and Hindus. So I think on that point, it's very clear that even the archetype of nonviolence is only appropriate in certain cases, and in large number of other cases is completely inappropriate. I'd like to just bring up, and I'll leave it for your response. I think your statement that the Soviet Union fell apart because of Václav Havel and some of the others is really is quite far from the accurate. Those might have to do with what went on in Czechoslovakia and Poland, but really the problems with the Soviet Union are much deeper and have to do with internal political and economic problems in the Soviet Union, and whether you want to attribute it to the Cold War and Ronald Reagan or something else, I don't think you could attribute it to the nonviolent resistance in Eastern Europe. So I'll hear your responses to that.
Well, go ahead, Mr. Kurlansky.
Okay. As far as the way India turned out, I am as certain as I could possibly be that Gandhi would agree with you. And in fact, towards the end of his life, he talked about how he felt that the people in India were not sufficiently prepared for nonviolence. But the fact that India did not turn out the way he wanted it to does not change the fact that he provided an example of a nonviolent anti-colonial struggle, you know, as opposed to what went on in Algeria or what went on in Vietnam or what went on in most of the countries of the world that tried to decolonize. So and that's why it's remembered as a great example. You're not being exactly fair on how you characterize his comments about Jews during World War II. What he said was that the Jews should resist through non-cooperation. Gandhi was never one for, you know, fall on your spear, on their spears. But he did talk about how non-cooperation could have been effective, and I think that's very true. And I think that there are numerous examples that show that how that would have worked in Denmark and in Berlin towards the end of the war. You had another point, but I'm sorry, I don't remember what it was.
Let me just say that quote, and I missed the first part, but in terms of Gandhi, that I took that from a book by Richard Dawkins, and I'm looking for the quote right now. It's in his book on the God delusion, and he specifically cites Gandhi talking about the Jews shaming Hitler by letting themselves be killed. And he has that quote from Gandhi. I can't find it at this moment.
Well, I don't know that quote. You know, he may have said that, but I you know have read a number of things he said about that, I think he had a point about non-cooperation and taking that quote. Well, it's hard for me to argue about that quote because I don't know that quote. But that was that summed up his view on the situation isn't quite fair.
Well, most of the Jews didn't cooperate in any way except that they got themselves killed in the concentration camps, and before they even got to the concentration camps, and a large number of Jews, didn't have any option. And if you say standing in line and being shot by overwhelming forces is cooperation, well, then, I don't know. I mean, to me, that seems like nonviolent as you could be, just as those who go into the gas chambers singing praises to God, which is what some of them did, is again, a nonviolent means.
It's nonviolent, but it's not resistance.
Well, okay.
The roundup of Jews in most occupied countries was done by Jewish community committees that were organized at the behest of the Nazi occupiers. There's a lot of examples of cooperation, which are generally explained by a misunderstanding of what was going on, what the purpose of the roundup was, and all of these things. We could get hopelessly lost.
Well,
I do think that there were opportunities for non-cooperation that were not taken in that instance.
Yeah, I do wanted to jump in here because we just have about 10 minutes left. I have a couple of the callers I'd like to include. I do wanted to thank the caller because I think the points he raises are very good ones and they're very difficult. I think they're appropriate questions to raise.
I do too. They're good points, and there's a lot of good points. You know, this is not it's not all easy.
Yeah, and I do also want to try to include a couple of other callers here who are waiting. And let's just simply go on to Champagne and the next in line number two.
Hello? Yes, I'm not fundamentally opposed to the position of nonviolence. I'm an African American from the South who lived in de jure discrimination there, and I benefited from the nonviolent model of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. However, as I listen to this, I also am a 22-year veteran of the armed forces, and I'm concerned about a concept, whether you accept it or not, which I was taught, and that is the concept of just war. Are you opposed to the concept of just war? And we were always told that we could look at Hitler's occupation of Europe in World War II and the Japanese militarism in the Pacific as concepts of just war that would allow military intervention for the better good. Does that concept ring true in your philosophy?
Well, the problem with the concept of just war is that, in all wars, all of the war makers declare the enemy to be heinously evil people, and therefore it's a just war. And so all wars get argued as just wars. I think that if you're talking at a theological level to Augustine's concept of just war, I think that it shot a big hole in Christianity that allowed war makers to rush in and allowed Christianity to become a church of warlike states.
But if you think about it, not getting back to Augustine's philosophy, wouldn't you think the quintessential examples of just wars would be the attack on Hitler's genocidal practices in Europe and Japan's genocidal practices in the Pacific?
Well, World War II was not an attack on Hitler's genocidal practices. In fact, the Allies refused to do anything to stop those practices, and even when asked by Jewish committees to do things to stop it, they openly said this is not part of the war effort. So often the justification of just wars comes about conveniently after the war is over. You know, it's like the Civil War. The Civil War was not fought to free slaves. But after the Civil War, you know, we are all being told that, you know, it was a great just war because it freed slaves. Freeing slaves was an unacceptable notion to most of the Union.
Okay, David, thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Let's go next to line 3, and this is Urbana. Hello.
Yes. Going back to the fall of the Soviet Union, it seems to me that Ronald Reagan is extraneous to the matter, that by the time he reached office, the Soviet Union was in a state of collapse, and that you have to go back to the 1940s and early 50s when George Kennan, George Marshall, Dean Acheson, and President Truman devised the strategy of containment, which was essentially a matter of using military power to avoid the use of military power in war, and that it was remarkably successful with a few exceptions. The Korean War did occur, and ended as a stalemate, which I suppose was a success. And, of course, we carried out the war in Vietnam, which was an extension of French colonial practice, and which was a disastrous failure for us.
But also an extension of the Cold War philosophy.
Oh, yeah, very much so. Yes. And that certainly didn't work. But the policy as such allowed dissension within the Soviet Union and without in the satellite states, which I think you must admit at least influenced those within the Soviet Union to essentially practice a nonviolent revolution, which brought down the Soviet Union in the end. Certainly not Reagan.
Yeah, I'm not sure where you're disagreeing with me.
I'm not disagreeing
with you.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm disagreeing with the former caller who...
Okay.
Well, and I think also, I don't mean to put words in the caller's mouth, but I think that it sounds like you fundamentally are agreeing with the guest and at the same time saying that that it is also more complicated than simply saying that having people who were resistors in the Soviet Union practiced non-compliance, and somehow that was enough to.
It is more complicated. It's always more complicated, and you know there were other factors in South Africa, and you know non-violence overthrew Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines, but 20 years of warfare in both the North and the South probably took a toll on him before that, and you know it's never cut and dry. I mean the work of of the women who marched in Buenos Aires every day against the military dictatorship is a spectacularly heroic example of nonviolence. But, you know, there were other factors there also. There are always complex factors. As you were saying about, you know, the examples of the Soviet Union and South Africa, that you have a situation that really isn't viable, and the question is, you know, what can you do, the people in the society, to encourage this thing that isn't working to fall apart?
Yeah. I have just a couple of minutes left here, and I'm thinking maybe we have one more. We have one more caller that I'd like to try to include in the time that remains. And just let me again say real quick, our guest, Mark Kurlansky, if you're interested in reading more of his thoughts on this subject, you look for his book. It's titled Nonviolence, 25 Lessons from the History of a Dangerous Idea. It is published by Modern Library. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. And I'm not sure if we do. Okay. Again, I guess I appreciate the questions that the callers have raised, because they're the right questions, and they suggest that what we're talking about here is perhaps more difficult, more complicated, not quite as straightforward as we would like it to be. And I guess I find myself going back to this question: well, what can nonviolence achieve, and what can it not achieve? And are you willing to say, yes, there are some things, in fact, that clearly it just can't do?
Well, I would say that there are some situations where I could not figure out how to make the nonviolence work. Hmm. There may be a better person than me that could, though.
Well, I do have a couple of callers here. We'll try to include maybe one or both. We'll go to Kankakee, line 4. Hello.
On the question of the heretical concept of the just war, wouldn't the recent slogan, WWJD, what would Jesus do, best govern? Thank you.
Well, you want to react to that?
I'm sorry, I had trouble hearing that.
The question, well, I think that, again, he was raising the issue of those people who make the just war argument. I think some people would go back to the example of Jesus, and he raised this now, used this now popular phrase, what would Jesus do? People are suggesting in any particular situation, you'd have to say, well, okay, what do you think that he would have done? I take it that the caller is saying that he would make the argument that there was no such thing as just war ever.
Yeah, I think so, which is why Augustine, some centuries later, made this argument, because he felt it was something, you know, it was an addendum to Christianity. The original Christianity, before it started getting revised, of all the major religions, was the most anti-war. Mm-hmm. But, you know, all religions, you know, the concept of jihad in Islam originally had nothing to do with violence, you know.
And still now Muslims will make the argument that's the important way to understand that is as a struggle, but in the sense of, you know, moral struggle, perhaps, or struggle of faith or
right.
Something like that, not the idea that you're going to convert people by force.
Right, and there's a huge theological argument that's going on within the Muslim religion between people who talk about the original theology and people who layer on violence and warfare in ways that are completely anathema to the teachings of Islam. This, as I say, goes on in every religion.
Try to get very quickly one more comment. Listener in Paris, Illinois, line number 1. Hello.
Yeah, I just wondered about if you could comment on the fact that maybe the Cold War, as practiced by the United States, was in itself a example of non-passive resistance.
Interesting question. You know, there's a lot of debate about what nonviolence is. For example, the embargo on Iraq before the war, a lot of people would not consider that to be nonviolence because it did so much physical harm to Iraqis in cutting off food and medicine. I was amazed in researching this book to discover how many books included the Intifada in nonviolent movements. I mean, throwing rocks is not nonviolent to my way of thinking. It's just low technology. I would not consider the Cold War to be nonviolent. I think that they used the word war intentionally, and it was the whole policy was constantly backed by the threat of war, as in the Kennedy speech, you know, pay any price. The Cold War led to many wars all over the world, you know, from Korea to Nicaragua, and if it was a nonviolent movement, it certainly failed in its intent, but I don't believe that that ever was its intent.
We're going to have to stop. I want to certainly thank the callers for contributing their ideas. If you're interested in sampling more of our guests on this subject, you look for the book that I've mentioned a couple of times here. The title of his book is Nonviolence, 25 Lessons from the History of a Dangerous Idea. Modern Library is the publisher of the book. You also might want to look at some of his other books, including 1968, The Year That Rocked the World, which sold very well, and some of his books about food, including the bestseller Cod, a biography of the fish that changed the world. If you want to read about something different, but certainly on this subject, you take a look at the book Nonviolence. Our guest, Mark Kurlansky. And Mr. Kurlansky, thanks very much.
Thank you, David. Pleasure talking to you and all of your very smart callers.
Yeah, thank you.